It's not exactly common knowledge, but there's a scientific revolution going on in the field of death and dying. Breakthroughs in resuscitation medicine are prolonging life far beyond what used to be possible, to the point of reviving some patients even hours after they were declared clinically dead. Steve Paulson's been following one of the world's leading researchers in this area, NYU intensive care doctor Sam Parnia. So, Steve, I want to ask you to set this up. Who is Sam Parnia? What do you want people to know about him?
Well, Sam is a British-born physician who's really for 30 years has been on the front lines of this new science that's redefining how we think about death. And he really wears two hats. And the other big thing that he studies is near-death experiences, what actually happens. And he's just written a book called Lucid Dying, where he is bringing all of this work together.
You've known him for a while. What's he like?
He has strong opinions. He does not shy away from controversy. For instance, he doesn't actually like that phrase, near-death experience.
What does he want?
Well, he thinks it's too fuzzy, too imprecise. People can sort of say, oh, they came close to death. That's an NDE. He prefers the phrase recalled experience of death, and he has a very precise definition. These are experiences that specifically happen after cardiac arrest.
So he would say Sebastian Younger didn't actually have a near-death experience because he didn't die.
Exactly, yes.
So you talked with Sam at a live event in New York recently, and before we hear the interview, I just want people to be able to picture the setting. Can you describe the place?
Yeah, so this was at the Morgan Library and Museum in New York, which was the home of J.P. Morgan, the famous banker, one of the great figures of the Gilded Age who ruled over Wall Street. And he had a private library filled with books, Renaissance tapestries, stained glass windows. It is truly one of the most spectacular rooms in New York City, but it's also a very intimate space, the perfect place for a conversation about one of the most sacred experiences in our lives, death. And I have to say, this was truly mind-blowing. So you've spent all of this time, decades, around death, when people are hovering between life and death. It's not too depressing?
Well,
to devote your life to this?
I hate to break the news to you. The way you presented it sounds very depressing. I don't see it that way. You and I have to talk marketing a little bit. You know? So I'm going to remarket myself to everybody, okay? So first of all, my job became to become an intensive care doctor, which means my job is to save people's lives. This field is advancing, and I became a subspecialist in cardiac arrest resuscitation. And so whether I like it or not, my colleagues and I, all of us, are following people and trying to prevent them from getting to the point of death, but yet we don't leave them alone when they go beyond death, and we bring them back to life. And so I find it incredibly rewarding. So I find nothing more exciting than that, actually. If you want to join, you're welcome.
So my sense is that the definition of death has changed quite a bit in recent decades. And I mean, there was a time when I think it was when the heart stopped. That was the definition of death. And then there was when the brain stops functioning. What is the current medical definition of death?
Nothing's changed. The problem we have in society is that we have an antiquated concept. The concept of a binary separation of life and death is incredibly antiquated. So to address your question, how do we define death? Death is very clearly defined. It's very easy. Any medical condition, accident, disease, anything you can think of that becomes so severe that it causes a person's heart to stop is death. That's why the term cardiac arrest, which is what we use in hospitals, and death are synonymous. It's the same biological process. But what has then happened in the 1950s and 60s, people who would otherwise have had catastrophic brain injuries were being kept alive on ventilators, life support machines. And so what doctors began to discover is that while they're on the ventilator, they can have a situation where their brain damage becomes so severe that the brain actually dies, but they're still on a ventilator, so they look like they're alive. So it led to a legal, and this is important, it's a legal notion that you can be declared dead if your brain has died while you happen to be on a ventilator.
Okay, but you are saying there's this gray zone. It's not exactly clear if someone is dead or not. It's not as if there's a single moment when someone dies. It's more of a process. Is that fair to say?
Yes, sort of. I think that the reality is that, again, the problem we have, and I keep saying this, is that we want to think of this binary notion mm-hmm. of life and death. And once you give someone the label of death, it's supposed to be the end. Like, there's nothing. to sort of move forward, maybe it's better if I explain my own journey in this. When I started out in the 1990s, I had a lot of resistance from people because they thought I was crazy. You know, why are you interested in this? It makes no sense. Is this religious? Is this spiritual? And so on and so forth. But what happened towards the end of the 90s, early 2000s, was a revolution started to take place in this field. And what happened, first of all, was that scientists looking for options to find better ways to grow brain cells to deal with diseases like dementia or Parkinson's and stroke, started to go to mortuaries, and they took biopsies of dead people's brains. So my point is, they are really dead. This is not a play with word. It's not like, oh, they were close to death. They were really dead. And they took their brain, and they were able to grow brain cells from Jack, Joe, Smith, whoever you can think of, in the petri dish in a lab. And over time, that field has grown into what we now call brain organoids. And there are growing brains in the lab from cadavers, from dead people, that are reaching the size of a fetus brain. And it's fully functional. So they were doing that to find cures. Then the other thing that happened, which, as you know, I love to talk about, and I can either wait for you to ask me the question or I'll just go ahead and talk about
it. Are we going to talk about pigs now?
We're going to talk about pigs.
Okay,
we have to talk about the pigs.
The pig study. So the pig
study. I have
study.
A one-track mind. That's all I ever talk about is the pig study.
So the pig study. I mean, I'll introduce this. So a few years ago, a group of scientists went into a slaughterhouse to find decapitated pigs and took away the heads and then grew brain organoids.
No, not quite.
Okay.
So let me go with the story then. But I want to explain that even in the 80s, it became very clear that you could have animals, cats, who had died and who had no blood circulation for over an hour, and scientists were able to restore activity again. But most people didn't realize it. And so we can fast forward, I don't have enough time to go through all of it, but we'll fast forward to 2019, where a study was published in Nature, which is probably the most or one of the most prominent scientific journals, by a group of scientists led by Dr. Nenad Sestan from Yale. And what they were able to do is absolutely astonishing, and it shows the point I made. They went to a slaughterhouse. These were not experimental animals. These were regular animals that were turned into sausage meat. They took decapitated brains 4 hours after the animals were killed. So these brains were left for 4 hours. And you can't be more dead than decapitated dead. And then they took them to their own laboratory, and they connected special tubing. They actually called it a brain in a bucket, so they put it in a bucket. They connected tubing, and they put a special solution through the blood vessels, and they waited 6 to 10 hours. And so what do we think happened? All of the brains, 32 times, all of those pig brains came back to life. They restored full activity. There was biological activity, metabolic activity, the blood vessels were responding appropriately. It was so astonishing that when they showed other scientists those dead brains, they thought they were looking at healthy brains. These scientists, and I've spoken to them at length, there's nothing hidden, it's all come out now. They were so concerned with the fact that they were restoring life to a dead pig brain that they decided to significantly downplay their findings. They came out with a term like they said, well, we've restored biological activity, or as they said, metabolic activity, but this brain is not alive. It doesn't make any sense. You know, a brain that has biological activity is alive. They were also so concerned, and you can appreciate this, by the possibility of restoring consciousness. So imagine you're a pig. Now you wake up. You find your brain in a bucket and you're conscious. You can't squeal. You can't move. You can't do anything. And you're trapped. So what they did was they gave sedative drugs. They gave drugs to block any signs of consciousness emerging in the brains, and they declared that the brains had not been conscious. We have no idea what happened, but the fact was that they did it.
And to extrapolate from this, presumably if you could do that with a pig brain, you could do that with a human brain.
That's exactly right. The technology exists now to do that with a human brain. And the fact what they showed is that after we die, for hours of time post-mortem, it is possible to restore brain activity. And of course, the rest of the body is part of that equation too. So that means we can revive dead people. So that is a major, major discovery. I personally think it's the biggest discovery that will undoubtedly lead to a Nobel Prize.
Wow.
The point is, we're making incredible discoveries that will help us not only find how to save people's lives, but also explore these deep questions as to what happens to all of us when we go through death. So no longer should we think of this as a religious question or a philosophical question. We have science. And that's why I, again, will tell you, I find my job incredibly exciting, and I do not like your marketing of my job. So if you invite me back in 10 years' time, please bear that in mind.
So just to follow up on what these recent discoveries have meant for people in hospitals or in EMT units, how do you save a person who suddenly has the heart attack and, you know, is in the state? I mean, it's your first thing is to cool the body, right?
Well, there's a lot that we can do. Unfortunately, again, the usual practice across the world is antiquated. People are doing what they did in 1960, which is terrible. What we should do, so people, everyone's familiar, you know, you do chest compressions, you give oxygen, you may shock the heart, you may give drugs that are very powerful and so on. But that's really, to me, that's ancient. That's like driving a Model T Ford and being happy that you're driving. It's ridiculous, frankly. The way I would like to do this, recognizing the science, means that we take people who die and we should connect them to catheters that will enable us to distribute oxygenated blood, nutrients, but also a cocktail of drugs like the Yale scientists did that will preserve the brain further and enable us to bring them back to life, assuming that the underlying condition that caused them to die is treatable. I can't do this to somebody who's 90 years old with metastatic cancer whose body is completely devastated. But if I myself have a heart attack, which being a man and of my age, I'm at risk of, I shouldn't die.
Steve's talking with Sam Parnia, an intensive care doctor at the NYU School of Medicine, and we'll hear the rest of their conversation after the break. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We think of life as synonymous with a heartbeat, and death is the moment when it stops. But when medical science figured out how to bring at least some people back from death, everything we thought we knew began to change.
Prompt action and careful attention to the details of CPR have restored the pulse of life to another heart that is too good to die.
Think about it. For thousands of years, life and death seemed very black and white, very clear. Your heart stopped, you were dead, that was it.
With every breath, you should see the chest rise and fall.
CPR was discovered in 1960. By the mid-1970s, so only about 15 years after that, a book was published that had the testimonies, particularly of 50 people in detail, who had come close to death.
I saw that what was there was love and nothing else. Loving perfection.
They were describing similar, very profound experiences.
There are no sins. Not the way you think of them on Earth.
Even though the doctors thought they were dead, from their own perspective, not only were they not dead, their thinking becomes clearer than usual.
It was so simple.
And their consciousness feels vast.
Complete love and acceptance for everything.
They're gaining visual and auditory knowledge of what's happening to them.
Knowledge that I had known before.
But it's not in the way that we see things, like, oh, this is how I'm looking directly. They describe 360-degree vision. And then what I find absolutely remarkable is the ability to recall everything that they have done in their entire life.
Everything.
All their intentions, their thoughts, their emotional states, in an instant.
How on earth did I ever forget anything that important?
So that's what I'm saying is, you know, the way people talk about near-death experiences, it really does a disservice. They're reliving themselves in the context of how they conducted themselves.
What is in your heart?
And whether what they did was right or wrong.
And the next thing I knew, that was it. I was back.
They're reliving it, not just from their own perspective, but from the perspective of other people they interacted with.
So let's go back to Steve's conversation with Sam Parnia at the Morgan Library in New York and to the question of why so many reports of near-death experiences describe this kind of profound moral reckoning.
I'll give you an example. There's a young lady who we interviewed. Her name's Rachel Finch. She's in our film. She was only about 20 when she was in this state when she almost died. She was in hospital and she became unconscious. And she had this experience. And I said to her, I said, well, her, you know, because, you know, she's a very sweet person. I said, well, what have you done? And she said, well, you know, I was young. I haven't done anything really that bad in my life. But as a teenager, I used to go into fits of rage with my father, my sister. And in that state, I was experiencing all the things I was telling her and the hurt I was causing her just through my words. And I felt them all. I felt the pain that they were feeling. You know, another thing she talked about, which was really incredible, was she talked about how she had, when she was an 8-year-old kid, she had a pet guinea pig. And she said one day the pet guinea pig came to bite her, did bite her, and she threw it onto the sofa. And nothing happened, you know, and she forgot about it. In her death experience, she relived that whole experience. And now she felt the fear that the guinea pig had felt, which is why it initially bit her. And when she tossed the guinea pig onto the couch, she felt how much worse the guinea pig, how much more afraid the guinea pig felt. Now think of something as simple as that, an 8-year-old tossing their pet guinea pig. So what I find amazing is that these people, even though they've had tremendously humiliating experience because they relived everything, when they come back, they all use it as a stepping stone to become better. Like a scientist who fails and says, okay, I need to do this better. I need to learn from this. So it's really interesting. The details of the experience are fascinating.
So let me run through some of the explanations that I've heard commonly to explain what are typically called near-death experiences. You prefer the term recalled experiences of death. But anyway, so for instance, the body floating up, what is referred to as out-of-body experiences, you can stimulate that with an electrode to the brain.
That's not true, but people say it.
The bright lights, the tunnel, that has been explained by hypoxia, the loss of oxygen.
Am I allowed to say that's not true?
Yes, you please.
People believe it. Some people believe it.
But the sense that when you're in coma, the brain totally flatlines, and then you report these extraordinary experiences. You know, how is that possible if the brain has flatlined? Or is it because actually these experiences are sort of being remembered as people are starting to come back online, regain consciousness? Why is not that a legitimate explanation?
So again, you ask wonderful questions, which I appreciate. And I'm just joking with you, by the way. I tease you a little. We don't mind. So the reality of this is that when these people first started to describe these experiences, people rejected them. Some scientists rejected them and simply said, you're either fabricating, you're just making up these stories, or you're basically hallucinating. They can't be hallucinating, and I'll explain to you why. One, because it's impossible to tell somebody that you reliving your entire life is a hallucination. A hallucination is something that occurs to people in an awakened state. It doesn't apply to people who are in a coma and so on. But nonetheless, you or I reliving our life is not a hallucination. The other issue with hallucinations, which is important to point out, is whenever somebody hallucinates, even if the hallucinatory experience feels incredibly real to them while it's happening, after they recover, they realize that it was not as real as ordinary real events in life. With the death experience and the recalled experience of death, what happens is completely the opposite. So not only are they recalling real events that occurred or their own life, but importantly, when they come back, they consistently will always say that this was more real than the most real experience you could ever think of. So my graduation or my daughter's wedding or whatever you can think of, really meaningful real events, pale into insignificance. Again, there's a huge difference between how real that feels and how these feel. And I think as we move forward in time, what we found is that some scientists started to no longer sort of reject and say, well, you're making this up, and say, well, it must just be a trick of your brain. As your brain is dying, it's creating all these wonderful images. But again, it doesn't make sense. Like, how would you suddenly know everything you've done? It's not really the case.
Well, let me just while I'm throwing out these biological explanations, another one is that there's this phrase of what's been called terminal lucidity, right as someone is dying, suddenly, like, everything comes alive. And, you know, maybe they were kind of fuzzy and losing cognitive function. And then this is the last gasp of the brain and the body sort of trying to fire everything up. Everything is jolted. And then suddenly, that's why you have this brief period of lucidity before you die.
So we're beginning to come to a point where we might start to agree a little bit. The problem we have is that when you come across something that doesn't make sense to you and it challenges your beliefs or your value systems or what you've come to believe, naturally what people often do is just reject it or come out with theories like, oh, well, you're clearly, you know, there, Mrs. Smith, I know you think you saw the doctor, but you were clearly hallucinating. And so that's why people came out with this idea of a lack of oxygen or, you know, I can just stimulate your brain and I'll make you have an illusion. But none of them were confirmed. So that's why those theories came about. The way our brain works, right now, audience, yourself, our brains are developed in a way that we try to make the most meaning and optimize our situation for what we need. So right now, many of the functions of our brain are shut down, they're inhibited through braking systems, so you and I can concentrate on this conversation. In different circumstances, other pathways are activated and those ones are shut down. So in death, what happens is, paradoxically, because people think death is this rapid degeneration, which it is not, what actually happens in death is remarkable. When a person dies, the brain switches. So things that no longer matter, like what you're going to eat, your job, your career status, and so on and so forth, are lost. People don't have any awareness of that. Your brain stops functioning from what we can measure. There's no pupillary reflex. Your brainstem is gone. So the person is dead. But in that state of death, or as we go into the state of the gray zone of death, other braking systems are removed. We call that disinhibition. And so one of the things you see, for example, is that the brain actually spews out tremendous amounts of hormones that are trying to save a person's life. It releases steroids and adrenaline and so on and so forth. And in many cases, it can spontaneously restore life again. So appreciate that. Your brain is designed to bring you back to life again. At the same time, genes that you had that were last active when you were a fetus that repair damage and have been dormant your whole life suddenly become active post-mortem. They're trying to repair any damage that's occurring. One of the other things that's happening in this state of disinhibition, the pathways that get activated, we think, is that it's removing the braking systems to your consciousness, as you pointed out, is holding you down, and suddenly a person finds that their real consciousness is vast, and it had been held down, and they're suddenly able to do things they couldn't do before. So it looks like in death, your brain is preparing you for a new reality. And in that state, you are gaining access to new dimensions of reality, which suddenly become more important to you. And we have to ask ourselves, and you asked me this question, why is it that suddenly in death, the only thing that seems to matter to people is how they were from a moral and ethical standard? Nobody in death, for example, in this death experience that you talked about, looks at their career status. What it all boils down to is how they conducted themselves.
So earlier you said that these were science questions now, and that we should take some of these questions out of philosophy, out of religion,
yes,
because they've been sort of distorted. And yet it seems like we're back there in philosophy, in religion, in what we make of what I would call spiritual experience here, because there's only so much that science can explain about these probably few hours after someone has died, has had cardiac arrest. And the question obviously is, what happens to consciousness after that?
Well, again, I think we can only extrapolate what we've learned so far. But if you think about the way we perceive about death, if you think of death here and now you're degrading, what would you anticipate, based upon that model, that consciousness is produced by the brain, if people believe that, which is debated, of course, but if you believe that for a moment, as your brain function is degrading, what would you expect to happen to your consciousness? Would it become heightened and vast and more powerful than it's ever been in your normal living state? Or would it also become diminished and degraded? And the reality that we see is that in death, as I said, paradoxically, people's consciousness does not start to wither away. If anything, it becomes released more vast and more powerful than it has been. So I think that my own understanding of what occurs with consciousness and how it relates to the brain is that I think human consciousness, our selfhood, is more like something like an electromagnetic phenomenon. So in other words, it can carry sound pictures. It's a very subtle type of entity, and it interacts with the brain. It's not magical. It exists. We need the brain to show it, like the same way you need a computer to be able to get the content off of the internet, but the brain or the computer doesn't produce that content. If we accept that for a moment as a hypothesis, then it explains everything. It explains why in death, suddenly, because communication is occurring through this sort of flux of energy, flux of electromagnetic phenomena. And so I think that may explain why that young girl was able to understand her pet guinea pig's emotions. Again, if this was an anecdote, I would have rejected it. But there are so many people who don't know each other who say the same thing.
Can I just say that the way you've talked about death here, it doesn't sound so bad. In fact, it sounds kind of wonderful.
You're the one who said it was bad. I never said it was bad.
So I guess I'm wondering, do you look forward to your own death?
So the people who have had these recalled experiences of death, I've heard some of them say that I'm not afraid of death. They really are transformed and changed. They develop a greater sense of meaning and purpose to their lives. They become less materialistic. They're more altruistic. They're more engaged with helping others and so on. And they're not afraid of death. I don't think of it that way so much myself. I'm still, I guess, as you've seen, I'm so engaged with my life in terms of both my family. I have a small child. But also, I want to take this field somewhere in the next 20 years before I'm forced to retire, probably, or ill health forces me to do that. So I don't necessarily look forward to it, but I'm not afraid of it, if that's what you're asking me. I now recognize that it's nothing to be afraid of, and I recognize that, again, based upon all the data that we've studied, I don't think my consciousness is going to die, and I think I'm going to experience something much more powerful than I'm able to experience right now.
We could go on, but we don't have more time. So thank you. Thanks to Sam Parnia. Thank you to our wonderful audience.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Sam Parnia, the director of critical care and resuscitation research at the NYU School of Medicine. This was part of our series, Spirituality in the Age of Science, recorded at the Morgan Library in New York in partnership with the Neuro Foundation. And if you want to see some of this conversation, there is a link to the video of the complete thing on our website at ttbook.org.